Rebecca Huntley returns to Conversations today. Rebecca is a well-known social researcher. For nearly 9 years, she travelled all over Australia, taking the country's emotional temperature, listening to groups of people as they talked about what matters to them. And Australia, she discovered, is a mess of contradictory opinions. Parents are too damn busy to take care of their kids, and they're always hovering over them. We are becoming a nanny state, and the government should definitely do something about that. Politicians ought to just make a decision and move on. But why don't they consult more? Migrants are taking our jobs and filling up the dole queues. No one goes to the pub anymore, and binge drinking is completely out of control. Rebecca Huntley has found that women are, by and large, completely exhausted from overwork, and they're underpaid as well, and that too many men lack friendship networks. And yet, Rebecca's research has told her that we are a better country than we think we are. She says that we are more generous and more progressive than our political leaders, and we have more in common than we know. Rebecca Huntley's book is called Still Lucky: Why You Should Feel Optimistic About Australia and Its People. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Richard.
How did I go summing up those contradictory opinions there?
Oh, yeah. I think you did extremely well. It goes to the heart of it, which is that anybody that, whether you're a psychologist or you're a behavioural scientist or you're an economist or the best economist, recognise that human beings are irrational.
Yes.
And there's nothing particularly, there's good and bad things about that.
I think I've said all of those things at one time.
And is there a difference between, is there an alcohol consumption between when you say one and then four or five glasses of wine and then when you say another?
I got it round the wrong way. You start off with binge drinking is completely out of control and then you end up tearing, going, no one goes to the pub anymore. That's what happens. That's normally what happens.
I think so.
Yes. Shame, Richard, shame. Let's talk first of all about how you went about this process of research when you would go to people's homes. How would you do this, Rebecca?
Yeah, look, it was an approach to research that my predecessor and mentor, Hugh McKay, did for years. And it's very much in opposition to how people imagine traditional market research, which is a little bit like a kind of, you know, soulless interrogation in a room of, you know, people around a table with a clipboard and then always the client behind the NYPD mirror kind of looking constantly at people. And that's not to denigrate that kind of research. I do that kind of research as well. But that's our traditional view. Hugh's approach and the approach that I used for nearly a decade is that we would go to people's homes, and that in itself is illuminating. So you see parts of Australia that you wouldn't normally go and see, and you experience people's homes and the insights from that. And so very basically, 20-year-old boys are really bad at catering, but 60-year-old men get a lot better at catering. Something happens between 20 and 60, that is excellent. And the other thing that it's clear is that we have a lot of stuff.
We do?
We have so much stuff. Yeah, we don't know what to do with it.
And when you go into that living room to meet that group of people of, I don't know, 60-year-old men or 40-something first-generation migrant women or something like that, what are you like? How do you present yourself?
Well, one of the things that's clear is that they always think you come in with an agenda, so that you want to find something and you want their comments to validate it. So, and they also look to you to direct the discussion and to shut stuff down. And a traditional social research would do that. You direct the discussion. You wouldn't trust the discussion to have its own logic and to air views properly. So I generally dress down. You know, I try not to dress in pajamas. I don't love to dress in pajamas.
Just one peg up from that.
That's right. It's one peg up from pajamas. It's certainly not in a suit. And part of it is that I would sit on the outskirts of the group. I mean, it's a friendship group that would normally get together anyway. It's quite nice to, you know, one of my favourite groups were either religious groups or sporting groups. So after the practice or after the golf game, book groups were always great. They would say, "Oh, good, we don't have to discuss the book," because we always feel bad when we don't discuss the book. So you'd already harness that existing rapport. You dress down, you'd sit behind and, you know, behind the group or in the periphery, and you wouldn't be trying to dominate it, and you wouldn't be dressing like you were, you know, the person with the jacket and the, you know, the high heels. So,
yeah. See, after all, ideally, if I'm doing my job as an interviewer, I can get the guest to forget I'm here, or sort of, you know, merge into the background. Is that what you're trying
exactly.
to do?
Exactly. You are trying to do it. I mean, knowing too that they are going, there's going to be a little bit of performance, there always is. But what I always love about friendship groups, I remember vividly one group where a whole lot of 30-year-old men were asked them, you know, generally a very open question, what have you been talking about? What's been on your mind? And this man said, oh, you know, I'm really very worried about what's happening in the Middle East or something. And somebody, his friend said, no, you're not. I can't say it. I can't say it on radio. He said, you've been talking about your renovation for weeks and that's all you've been talking about. And he said, yeah. So so we dispensed with the discussion of geopolitical politics and talked about his renovations.
Well, you see, this is what I was going to ask you this much later, but it seems I got an answer to this question. I was just wondering if, I suppose if you're asking groups of friends, they call each other on their
Absolutely.
Stuff rather yeah. than, because, you know, people will often say, well, I feel I ought to be concerned about this and yeah. I ought to be concerned about, but yeah. they're really talking about this and they're really talking about
yeah,
that.
And I think that's right. And you know, that's one kind of fun example. But what used to always interest me is that when you would go into a group, and there were certain years where you go into a group and in some ways perception would think this group is not going to care about this issue. So I might be in a regional area with a whole lot of men over 60 and the numbers or the perception would be they don't care about climate change. But you'd say, what have you been talking about? And they'd discuss climate change and they'd sometimes have a real barney about it, with some guys saying it's real, we've got to do something about it, and other guys saying, I don't like the scare tactics. So, and they would also reference times when they'd talked about it before. So you realise that's a genuine conversation and that's not being something that's been led by you. And when something like that happens, when these completely spontaneous discussions about issues that aren't being, let's say, pushed by the media, or you wouldn't normally expect that group, or have a perception that that group would care or discuss that issue in any kind of depth, then you think, well, something interesting is happening here. This is a organic-led discussion rather than I saw this on the TV.
Given that you're often asking, well, you are asking these groups what matters to them and about things that are important to them, do sometimes people become completely upset and start and burst into tears and fall apart in front of the group? Does that happen? And then do you have to step in if that happens?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, again, because it's in a friendship group, they are more candid. There's been some really emotional moments. And look, the key is we ask them not to drink alcohol, but we sometimes can't always control that. So people will talk about things that they've gone through, and mainly very personal things. So it's in relation to breakdowns, issues with their kids. And I, you know, struck constantly by amazing stories where people would say, I think I start the book with a story about a group of men that I met in Adelaide, all in their mid-50s, and they'd kind of found, you know, middle-class guys, but they'd all kind of found themselves subject to age discrimination and suddenly kind of, you know, retired in their mid-50s, realised that their relationships, they'd been, you know, ignoring their relationships, they realised they needed to rebuild their lives. All of these men talked about going through periods where they couldn't get out of bed. And all of these men, with the help of each other, that network, managed to rebuild their lives. And some of them said to their wives, okay, you go back to work. I can't find anything. I'm going to learn how to make the lamb roast. They all said it wasn't very hard. Learn how to do the laundry. Found joy in being with their grandkids. Found joy being in their male relationships. So those men didn't cry, but it was moving. It was really moving, and it made me realise just how essential it was for men at that age to keep up their relationships outside the family network, hugely important to revitalising their lives. So if I think back, I think about all those moving stories about people reflecting on moments of their life when things were difficult, but they managed to pull through.
You found a couple of little odds and sods just over the 9 years. One thing is that whenever there's government largesse, whenever there's a government payment, like there wasn't during the GFC, you say Australians always assume it's being spent on plasma screen TVs.
Exactly.
It's true. You go, well, if you give them that, they're just going to spend it on plasma screen TVs.
That's exactly right.
Australians always will say that.
Absolutely. And there were times when you would look around and go, well, where are the plasma TVs? There's one or two, but I can't see four or five.
Right. Like my payment I used to invest in my future. But those people there, they're exactly. buying big TVs
the
that they shouldn't
TVs.
Have.
Big TVs.
The other thing you've learnt the importance of is another key economic indicator, the banana index. What is the banana index, Rebecca, and how does it work?
Well, look, the banana, and all of my research team would reflect on this. The moment that bananas shot up, you know, from whatever, $4 or $5 a kilo to, you know, $9, $10 or whatever, mainly because of a weather event, suddenly you'd get all this anxiety about, you know, you would think we were a nation of monkeys or something. I don't know what we were doing. You would just think it would just kind of trigger this endless, and then what's going to happen to tomatoes? And it would just kind of trigger this, this process in which everybody would get terribly anxious. And then a couple of weeks later, we'd see something happening with the consumer confidence index. You know, Westpac, you would suddenly get up. So we thought the bananas had this kind of seismic, cost of bananas had this kind of seismic effect on how people thought, cost of living was going. I laugh, but it would just happen all the time.
You know, as you say, I can just think of how many times I've been in the supermarket with my wife and go, oh, look at the banana price. What does it mean?
No, what does it mean?
Yeah.
And I think part of that is certain things do set us off and start making us worry. I mean, we're making a joke, but I suppose one of the things that was interesting about what I've observed in terms of the discussion around the environment is that while there's lots of, you know, concern and you know, electoral discontent over how we might deal with climate change, there's absolutely no doubt that people get the connection between climate change, extreme weather events, and the impact on day-to-day life and prices. So even though they might, you know, we might laugh about the jump up in banana prices, it does make people think, okay, well, there's going to be more of these once-in-a-lifetime weather events. It's going to affect all these crops we rely on. We're suddenly going to be walking out of the supermarket, you know, $7, $8, $9, $10 poorer than we were before, and that will have a kind of an escalating effect. So, even in something that's kind of funny and irrational, you get the rational and quite important, you know, takeaway that people get from something like that, from the banana index.
How well have you found, or how closely does the kind of debate that goes on in national media through newspapers and broadcast networks, how closely does that national debate align with the conversations you've been hearing over the last 9 years?
It does overlap, but it doesn't as much as people in the media assume.
Really?
Yeah. So I think one of the more common questions I've ever gotten from journalists is, what we write in the newspapers and everything really shapes what the agenda in the around the kitchen table.
Yes, and I would say, chins are stroked around the nation, and people exactly. go, yes.
And I think that's less and less the case. It's not completely. It's not the case, but it's not as much as journalists think. Perhaps they overestimate their influence on people.
Well, this is the thing that I think is always good to bear in mind. People like you and I are super interested in politics, Rebecca.
Yes, we are.
But that's weird.
It makes us strange.
Most people, by and large, just aren't that interested in politics unless there's a kind of giant event on their doorstep.
No, they're not. They're certainly not interested in the gossip around politics. Who's the shadow minister for, you know, regional, you know, infrastructure,
bananas.
Regional bananas. They've got really great instincts about politicians when they pay attention. That's absolutely true. So to go back to your point about the media, I think one of the things that made me want to write this book, and one of the things that almost turned me off from what I used to, one of those freaks who used to watch Question Time and pay a lot of attention to, you know, politicians speaking to each other and arguing, watch a lot of panel shows and read a lot of newspapers. I've almost withdrawn from it because the kind of the conflict, this idea that we're, you know, if you just looked at those things, you'd think that we were absolutely divided on key questions that face us. You know, we were at each other's throats about whether marriage equality is a good idea. You know, we're at each other's throats about renewables. We're at each other's throats about, you know, investment in education. You know, we've got these policy areas where you have these kinds of pitched battles, ideological battles in politics and the media, and that just didn't mesh with the conversations I was hearing constantly.
And these highly dramatic media conversations that go on about these issues, does that in turn feed media distrust?
It does. I think it absolutely does, as people kind of wonder what the connection is. Or they listen to talkback or they read columns and they think, oh, who are these people? So there's a kind of an alienation there. It's not to say that the media can't keep stuff on the agenda, but I'll give you an example. You know, when I started this research, there was a lot of media attention on climate change, which kind of, ended up kind of being dissipated and sucked into the discussion about, let's say, do we have an ETS or do we have a carbon tax?
Right, now this is the last years of the Howard government,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes, exactly.
When Howard was under a lot of pressure and eventually was persuaded to commit to one, should he be elected in 2007.
Absolutely. And then the first couple of years of Rudd. What was interesting is climate change kind of basically stopped being talked about, really, with such intensity in the media and politics. But it was still something that groups continuously raised. Not so much climate change, but the issues of, let's say, volatile weather and what we're going to do about our energy future. So even though it wasn't there in the headlines, it was there in people's consciousness. The thing can happen alternatively. It can flip around. You know, there were years in which, I mean, I actually remember this so vividly. The second, there are so many challenges between Rudd and Gillard, but I think it was the second challenge where Julie Gillard was Prime Minister and Kevin Rudd was challenging her the first or the second time, I can't remember. And all the media was screaming about it. And we were in field that week. We were doing groups all around Australia, including in Queensland. None of those groups raised the challenge. And so
really?
Much so, none of them.
Wow.
When we said, what are you talking about? What's the big issues around? What are you discussing? None of them. And we're talking about a really big cross-section, you know, teenagers, 20s, 30s, men, women, all kinds of backgrounds. I was so interested to get their response. At the end, I would often say, oh, what about the whole thing that we might have a different Prime Minister by the end of the week? I remember one woman said, well, that's got nothing to do with us. You know, why would we talk about it? It's got nothing to do with us. And it was at that moment I thought, it doesn't matter whether Kevin Rudd is the Prime Minister and leads the Labor Party the next election. They've lost because they've made the central issue of their party not about the electorate. So there's moments where you think it doesn't matter how much of obvious national importance something is, how much the media is screaming, people will not pick it up as something that matters to me.
This ongoing kind of media narrative of conflict over issues, which is actually really boring after a while, particularly it doesn't apply if it's not real.
Yeah.
You say this kind of disguises an underlying broad agreement on the kind of Australia most Australians want. Most of us agreeing on when we talk about the kind of Australia we all want?
Yeah, look, I think in very broad brush terms, and it wouldn't come as a surprise to people, in very broad brush terms, we realise that our days of an economy of digging stuff up from the ground and selling it off to other countries is over.
Most Australians think that?
Yeah. They realise that while mining will be a part of our economy, that is the Australia of the past, not the future. Not growing stuff on the ground. There's a general consensus that we need to protect and support Australian agriculture, not only for our own food security issues, but to sell food overseas. That's why, one of the reasons why, there's a level of, I suppose, electorate anxiety about the idea that there would be a lot of foreign investment in agriculture. Right, and there is nowhere near that level of anxiety about foreign investment in mining. So we worry about foreign investment in energy and we worry about foreign investment in agriculture for those reasons, because we think those are two areas that hold the key to our future prosperity. Broad support for investment in TAFE and higher education and making sure that that's not prohibitively expensive and making sure that government invest in that area.
Really? Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do people mean it when they say that? I know that's a funny thing to say. How sincere are people? I mean, people will want to be their best selves in front of you, Rebecca, won't they?
They'll say,
well, we want to invest in education. But, you know, if the government offers a really good tax cut that lands in my area, I might vote for the government on that.
I think it's an interesting point. The harder question is, and this is about, how do you get people from what they say they want, and I actually really do believe that's what they say they want, and what they're prepared to sacrifice personally to get that.
Right.
I think that's the key. And that is the question of leadership and advocacy. That being said, on a lot of these issues, and so you can't really lump them all together, you know, so if you take something like the broad acceptance that climate change is real, regardless of what's causing it and how it's happening, and that one of the keys to our energy secure future, but also to our economy, is to invest in, you know, renewables of all kinds and new inventions to make things more economically, less environmental pollution and more energy efficient. So that's a general principle that the vast majority agree with. How you get there and what you do and what I'm personally prepared to do in terms of sacrificing money or paying higher prices or putting more effort is a question of how you move people from a from where they are now to and reform and to a position of change. It is possible. I mean, I'm going to give one example. When there were significant drought in Victoria and New South Wales, and this was when I first started the research, there were quite significant government restrictions on what you could do with water. And even though there was cynicism amongst the electorate of both those jurisdictions about whether whether companies and big corporations were doing their share, it was extraordinary the extent to which people were prepared really to change their daily habits for this general goal of reducing water.
I'm so interested you bring this up. In the city of Brisbane, there was much the same thing. Dam levels around the early, around about 2009, were down to critically low levels. The city of Brisbane accepted a huge amount of water austerity, if that's the word for it. Water consumption was reduced by more than half in the city of Brisbane. And there was a shared sense, there was a bit of, you know, bitching and moaning about it, but not that much. There was a sense that it was fair, by and large, and it was evenly borne by the population, and people were quite proud of having been able to, having achieved that. There is a model there in water restrictions.
There is, and I think there's a couple of things there. First of all, they accepted the premise about where what needed to happen, right? They understood it; it was clear. They realised that behaviour had to be had to change, and they were prepared really to adapt quite significantly their behaviour, right? Because they also knew that this wasn't just a fleeting thing. So what was so interesting is when the New South Wales government in particular lifted those restrictions, there was an outcry. Yeah. Why would you possibly do this?
We've achieved this. Right.
Let's keep achieving it. So one of the things that is a little bit of a model about how you can mobilise the population around a shared goal that people understand, that people get, and they're prepared to at least sacrifice in terms of changing the way. I remember one man who said, I flush the toilet once a day. It doesn't matter if I do a number two. That's why I don't go to toilets in people. I would always go to the toilet before a group. But anyway, I remember that. So, look, I think that is, I mean, and some people would say, and rightly so, that the challenge of climate change, the broader challenge of climate change, and the broader challenge of what to do with, let's say, you know, the need of budget repair and the issues around investment in, let's say, childcare or education, that is more complex and that's a more urgent challenge. But I think that there, you know, I think I'm constantly disappointed at the inability of politicians, even when their stocks are high, and Malcolm Turnbull came in with extremely high stocks when he first became Prime Minister, of at least why don't they at least try? They just don't give it a good old, you know, they don't give it a good old try, and I would like to see them do that on some of these kinds of larger issues. So to go to your point about higher education, yes, people, that's a motherhood statement. Oh, of course, we need to invest in education. There's a larger question. What are you prepared to do? Pay more taxes? Are you prepared to sacrifice something in some area in order for that to happen, to have a world-class higher education system? That is a hard argument. But we have to remember, too, that people of all kinds, not just the kinds of people who used to access higher education and TAFE, but that is, you know, now the broad population, either want it for themselves or their children. They realise what's better for me to pay in the future, for me to be paying $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year for my kid to get a decent education so maybe they can get an unpaid internship for 2 years. So maybe, you know, maybe they can get, you know, maybe they'll be paying off education debt for a while. So there is at least the fundamentals there to have the argument to actually give it a red hot go. So, and I think that's certainly true for the broader question of climate change and for investment in education.
You find that there's no shortage of gloomy, worried, anxious comments from people that you've spoken to. There seems to be like a kind of slow leak of confidence in the last 10 years or so. Is that how you'd see it?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that the GFC, going through the GFC with the electorate, which is kind of what I felt I did, was interesting. You know, and there was just, you know, swings and roundabouts, you know, really kind of extreme swings of attitudes to that. It almost felt like a near miss. It was one of those things where, you know, we all have it in personal life where we do something really silly where we almost get, you know, hit by a truck or We almost, and then we think, oh, I'll never, you know, I was lucky, but I'm never going to make that mistake again.
Right, I'm just going to walk across when the green man tells me
something. Exactly, yes, rather than wandering across after a couple of margaritas. So one of the things that happened with the electrodes, even though we were kept being held up as an example to the international community of how you can avoid a global financial crisis, and we did in many ways, it made a lot of people think, oh, are we ever going to get that lucky again? And looking at the fundamentals of the way that not only our leaders work, but the economy works. And it was interesting that they went from thinking, we were protected by the GFC, by the mining boom, to very quickly saying, we've put all our eggs in the mining basket and we haven't invested in other parts of the economy and we haven't thought about building an economy for the future. So if something like this happens again, the mining boom isn't going to save us, and we don't see any evidence that our leaders, or whether it be in corporate Australia or in politics, are building a kind of nation that could avoid that a second time around.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
We were talking there about the kind of a slow leak of national confidence that you've seen over the last 10 years. But what happens when Australians go overseas and then come back home, Rebecca?
Oh, look, I think, and Australians do that. It's, you know, certainly what was interesting during the GFC years is that for various reasons we did that a lot. You know, the planes were taking off from all the national capitals, taking us overseas to Asia and Europe. Oh, look, we come back, not only do we love the taste of the water out of the tap and we smell the eucalyptus in the air, we recognise that there's a kind of a unique combination of factors here that make this a great place to live. I mean, it is extremely safe. It is also, it has a social safety net that's kind of held up despite years of economic rationalist policies pursued by both parties. So, I mean, at the end of the book, which I wrote the final part of the book the night that Donald Trump became president, and I thought, you know, really one of the things that most Australians feel when they come back is that this isn't necessarily the greatest country in the world, but it's a great country. And it's a great society. And if we compare ourselves to America, for example, you can't really call yourself a great society if it's easy to get a gun and hard to get healthcare. And it's the opposite in this country.
The last time I went to the United States was in 2011. I hadn't been there for about 10 years. And I walked away thinking, I never thought about this after visiting America, because I like America. I walked away thinking, I'm really glad I don't live there. And I don't think I've ever felt that way about the United States before. But there is this kind of a growing sense, I notice, I don't know, this is purely anecdotal, that Australians by and large do not want Australia to be like America. Are we getting more emphatic about that?
Oh, we are. And there was a point, I mean, I wasn't a researcher at this time, but my predecessor's work, Hugh McKay, there was very much a point where we, and particularly our political leaders, would look at America and think, you know, there's an enormous amount there that we need to emulate. And it's very, very hard to find that sentiment at the moment. And it doesn't really matter where you come from the political spectrum. And you see it most from parents who'd say, I don't want to raise my kids there. I certainly don't want to raise my kids in a school where there has to be metal detectors. And where issues, for example, that have been and will always be controversial in this country, like reproductive freedom and those kinds of things, they're just not, we're just not that kind of society, and people treasure that. And they treasure it, they still want to travel, they still have very much a global outlook, they want to, you know, everything on their social media feeds or everything they read, they like to read culture and movies from other countries. So we've got we're certainly very global, and this is the difference between the Australia of today and the Australia of Donald Horne. But, you know, we come back thinking we're still a lucky country, not in the way that Horne meant it, but in the way that we mean it.
There is a mismatch in your book between official unemployment statistics, which you've got. Where's the unemployment rate these days? 5-6% thereabouts.
Yep.
Thereabouts, and what people tell you about the job security that they have. Tell me a bit about that, the kind of mismatch you've noticed there.
Yeah, and this has got a lot to do with the changing nature of work. So there's huge scepticism about what that employment number might mean. And what I did when I did the research is I went back to look at the kind of undulating discussion about unemployment and work and how it went up and down. And it kind of, it basically synced with some, you know, significant shifts in the unemployment rate. But it's there consistently, and that's because we have more and more people who are on not permanent contracts. So they're working contract work, or they're working work, they're doing work that's shift work, or work that is doesn't have a lot of conditions attached to it. They feel like they're working as hard as they ever have before without either the kind of pay rises they've been expected to in the past. But not just, it's not just about pay rises, and this is what I have, this is a really important point. It's about the conditions that a permanent job, whether it be part-time or full-time, offer. It's about that sense of culture of being permanent. I remember doing a group actually very recently last week where somebody said the culture at work, the idea that your boss cares if you're getting training or gives you some days off sick, or you can have a dynamic conversation with them about when it's a good time to take a holiday. He said, that is priceless. He said, in the end, I could probably earn more money being a contractor and doing stuff, but having a place where I feel like I'm learning and contributing and that I, you know, a place of work where I feel like I belong, is that that's priceless. And that is the majority view. And that kind of world of work is disappearing. There's a lot of things that are making that happen. But it means that this kind of sense of job insecurity and what am I getting back for my labour and where am I going is just a big concern. The other concern, of course, too, if we think about it, and this is part of changing demographics, Australians are entering the workforce because they're taking qualifications and doing other things because they feel they need to and they have to because the market demands it. They're entering the workforce later. But age discrimination, and we know this, kicks in at 50. So if you're entering the workforce at 25 and age discrimination in the workforce, some worse in some sectors than others, kicks in at 50, you've got 25 years to buy a house, have kids, afford childcare and pay and organise your retirement. That is actually impossible. If age discrimination kicked in at 50 and like in the old days you started work at 14, you might have some luck, mainly because you might be dead at 60. But we have a completely, you know, mismatched labour market and labour market conditions to the demographic change that is happening. Because most of us, if we get to 60, we'll end up getting to 90. And, you know, so that is something that the electorate understand. It makes them worry. It makes them think about not only how am I going to stay in work, how am I going to look after my parents, help my kids, look after my grandkids. So, you know, there's those kinds of things that a sheer employment number just cannot encapsulate.
Yeah, I'm a Generation Xer like you are, Rebecca.
We are.
And so our perspective is going to be a little different from a baby boomer or a Gen Y or a millennial.
Yeah.
We're going to use those great big ugly lumps to define human beings, but let's just bear with me for the moment. Yeah. I think that kind of thing, that kind of jibes with my own experience in life. I suppose nearly all my adult life, I've had public leaders saying, we can no longer afford this.
Yes.
We can no longer afford that. And you'll have to pay more for what your parents did in the past for this or that thing. This sense of kind of decline, or not decline, but shrinkage of tightening, a slow, you know, boa constrictor tightening over what happens in the public sphere particularly has been a constant feature of my adult life.
Yeah. And it started with education when we first, didn't it really? It started the moment we went to university or TAFE or anything.
And of course, that conversation is often held alongside the knowledge that we've never been richer. And we can no longer afford that.
Exactly.
I mean, maybe that's just prudent management. Maybe that's what it is. But that's the conversation that's being held.
No, that's right. And look, we've been protected a little bit from the extremes of that. But it is that exact thing that you have described is why young people in Spain and Greece and in those kinds of countries that have, you know, really struggled economically, but are also ageing and have had previous generations who've been on incredibly, like really pretty, you know, substantial government support. This idea that that door would suddenly slam, it's been much more extreme in those kinds of communities than in ours. But it's a global problem, and it's one where, you know, if there's any kind of generational conflict that exists in our society, and it's often overrated, well, it's around that. It's this idea that, well, I'm still working, I'm still paying taxes, I've been subjected to user pays for a long time. You know, it's $1 million to even just get, you know, a cardboard shanty, cardboard shack, you know, close to the city.
Milk crate.
You know, continue to, and, you know, what does that mean for my future and my kids' future? It's a big thing.
Let's take another turn here. You take a good hard look at the a question that a lot of Australians find really unpleasant, just don't want to talk about, which is how racist are Australians? Australians will often say, well, yeah, there is racism here, but we're no worse than other countries. How true is that?
Look, it is true. I mean, I've gone up and down about this for 10 years. It's difficult for me because, you know, my family is I'm a third generation Italian, and I came to talk about work that I'd done about racism about my family in the 30s. So it's one of those areas that's very personal. It's one that I go back and forth on a lot. So I think that we can say that there are aspects of our history and our attitudes that are racist. And I don't think that's, you know, I just don't understand why that's a problem, because it's just recognising one of our issues along with recognising all the other great things. Like, you know, it's part and parcel of the complexity of our society.
Right. We're not completely perfect or utterly evil at the same
time.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think that we're, except in relation to Indigenous Australians and some exceptions, we're not a society where there is, and, you know, obviously examples like, you know, the Cronulla riots, we're not a society where there are kind of enclaves created because people are terrified about mixing. We are a successful multicultural nation, but there are racist attitudes out there, and they persist despite the relative racial harmony that exists. So when people say, oh, we're not as racist, I went to another country and they're really racist. One thing I would say is, well, we never make that argument when it comes to swimming. Like, if we did really badly in swimming in the Olympics, we came 10th on the ladder, we'd say, well, at least we beat Kazakhstan. We wouldn't. There would be a national inquiry. There would be a royal commission into why we didn't do it. So one of the things I would say is, one of the things I say about that is, look, I wouldn't want to overstate the level of racism in our society. I think we are a very a successful multicultural nation, but shouldn't we be more successful? Shouldn't we be less racist because we are so successful? And that's what I want to say. Like, I am worried about the persistence and the kind of almost determined persistence to kind of constantly recycle arguments about race and multiculturalism and in relation to asylum seekers that have patently been aired before and weren't true. So I'll give you an example about Pauline Hanson. I mean, when she first started her career, she was worried we were swamped by migrants. Asian migrants.
Specifically, yes.
Now she thinks they're fine. They can run her they can run her fish and chip shop. They're hardworking. It's the Muslim migrants we have to worry about.
Right.
So it's that kind of sense of, no, it's the same argument. It's the same fear that's largely turned out to be not true. Why do you think it's different now? So there's this kind of amnesia, and there's this cycle that I wish we could break in some
way. But isn't there a cycle there as well, whereby the new arrivals come in, they get a rough welcome, yeah, if you can say that.
It's kind of like a hazing they do.
Yeah, there's a hazing. then the next lot line up to come in, and then the previous group of migrants join the larger group, and they go, I don't know about them people.
That's exactly
right. I don't know.
Right.
That's been happening since the year dot in this country. You know, there was complaints about the Irish coming to Australia, saying they come over here in boats, they have too many children, they're loyal to a foreign religious leader.
They are.
That was being said in the 19th century about the Irish.
And it's almost like you've become fully Australian as the first generation of migrants. Could you get a new generation of migrants to pick on? They should give you that with it's almost like a right once you get the little tree to plant and the Vegemite, I get to pick on a new generation of migrants.
Oh, I shouldn't laugh, but that is pretty funny. Yeah. It's absurd, actually. Are you finding that when talking to first-generation migrants, they're going, I don't know about those boat people?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you really have to look kind of at the quantitative research to get a real understanding of this. The qualitative research still shows, and this is sometimes disheartening, I mean, even amongst group of asylum seekers and research that I've done with asylum seekers, even they are anxious about boat arrivals, not because they think that the people arriving are going to be terrorists or whatever, because they know about the reality of what it is to be an asylum seeker. They feel the tension that's already in the country about asylum seekers, and they think that more people coming in without the right support and in this would actually make it worse for everybody. So you even get anti-asylum seeker attitudes and anxiety amongst asylum seekers.
You detected a trend that's been with Australia since the Gold Rush in this, which is during the Gold Rush there was a lot of anxiety about Chinese labour coming in and undercutting the pay of Anglo-British migrants working in the goldfields, and that led to, you know, massacres and eventually the White Australia policy. But this is still here today. Do we see streaks of that? Like, in the beginning there, I sort of said, you know, these asylum seekers, they come here and they're going to get on the dole queues and then they're going to take all our jobs. I mean, that's a contradiction there, but Absolutely. That's a widely held thought still in Australia.
It's still held. So it makes you wonder what is the alternative? And of course, as anybody working in asylum seeker, particularly in asylum seeker, circles knows, there's real restrictions about the extent to which they can do any work. If you spend time with asylum seekers, they're actually quite upset that they're having to take money from the government. They want to be self-sufficient. They want to work. They recognise that work is the key to their integration. There was one, reviewing all the research of the last 10 years and before that, there was one really moving comment that a first-generation migrant said. So I'd done some groups the day before with some kind of non NESB groups and non-migrant groups, essentially, well, you know, that are migrants once upon a time, but they said, oh, look, the problem with these people coming from India and Pakistan is they work really, really hard. You know, they don't take a smoker, they make the rest of us look bad. And then after that, I was kind of reviewing some comments and this guy said, oh, we come to Australia and we think Australians are really hardworking, so we can prove to them that we can fit in if we work really hard. So what was extraordinary about that is that we still imagine ourselves as a nation of bludgers who want to take a smoker. It's actually not born by the statistics. Actually, we're quite hardworking. And anybody coming to this culture would think, right, all these Australians are really hardworking. If I'm hardworking, they'll accept me.
Are we really bad at telling a national story about this? All the data tells us that the huge influx of migrants from all over the world since the end of the Second World War has made Australia richer, more dynamic, more interesting, more, by and large, a more fun place to live. And yet, do we have trouble seeing beyond the benefits of the food court here, Rebecca?
Absolutely. It is very, very hard to get Australians, when you're really talking about immigration, unless they're thought about it deeply, when you say, well, what do you think immigration's done? Oh, better quality of Thai takeaway. And, you know, so you think, well, there's more to that. You know, there really is. It's fundamental to our national story. Part of it is a story that needs to be told over and over in different ways to reflect current conditions and to deal with current anxieties. Our politicians have become bad at that. So just that comment that you made now, that multiculturalism is fun. I mean, look, people get it. If you really say to them, well, what if we went back to the 1950s? They don't really like that. They recognise that actually the 1950s in Australia was not particularly fun for everybody. You know, there was the 6 o'clock swill and there was, you know, a whole range of things. It was insular. There was lots of, you know, censorship of books and movies. So they recognise we can't go back there. But we really do need better advocates for how fundamental immigration has been to our national story. It's getting better, but I think it could be so much better because the story is largely such a good one.
You open your chapter on women with this sentence. You say, Australian women are exhausted. Now, Rebecca, I know I'm going to get in trouble for asking this question, so take it as a Dorothy Dixer, please, but why are Australian women? Why are women so tired? I mean, is that exhausting even to even answer that question?
I think lots of people have written extremely well about this. Annabel Crabb wrote a great book called The Wife Drought about it. I think one of the things that has happened to women is that they have stepped in the last 30 years in an extraordinary way in terms of education. They're kind of kicking butt in all levels of education. They're working hard. They're still, it's still more likely that we're in part-time work, but as we know, part-time work is not what it used to be. Lots of women are working part-time but actually kind of killing themselves at work and texting on the, you know, when they're not at work. So we've stepped into the public sphere in a significant way, but we have not stepped out of the things that we did before we stepped in significantly into the public sphere. So we're still doing all this our stuff with our kids. Really annoys me when people say, oh, parents just, you know, parent on remote control. It's just actually not true. Not only is it not something I've experienced when I've spent time with parents, there's no data to support it.
Anecdotally, I am absolutely certain parents these days parent much more closely than they did when I was a kid.
Absolutely.
It's like, you kids get out of the house and don't come back till it's dark.
Absolutely.
Was how it used to be.
Yeah. Exactly. And so again, to go to your introduction, in those kinds of groups that talk about this, they say, oh, you know, in my day, I used to wander the neighbourhood with the dogs and you just, you know, and you could do what you want. You could swing on the rope and throw yourself in the creek. And then they went, but parents these days, they parent through remote control. They don't pay any attention to their kids. And it's like, but what is happening here? And as a lot of people say, you know, in the days we used to let kids wander around the neighbourhood, occasionally they'd go under a car and occasionally they'd drown in a creek, you know, that kind of stuff. So we do have a very, you know, these are the inconsistencies between the imagination of the, you know, our nostalgic view of the past and our kind of anxious view of the how it is in the now and how it'll be in the future that just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
You've been speaking to men's groups of all different kinds of ages. First, how do they vary and how has the conversation about the cooking and the cleaning changed, if at all, in the last 10 years, Rebecca?
Oh, look, I think it has. The data supports that it hasn't changed dramatically enough, but I think it is changing, and I think that to not acknowledge that it's changing is a problem because it looks like, you know, we're pointing fingers, and I don't entirely want to do that. I mean, I'm always interested to see the extent to which fatherhood now and grandfatherhood is a much more active, reflective activity. You just don't get men who say, oh, you know, I'm just going to need to, you know, smack them around the head every now and then and win them, you know, bring the money in. And that kind of traditional view of the kind of not nurturing father is not a popular one, regardless of generation, I have to say. I've had a bit of a skewed view about men, I think, in some ways. A good skewed view is that I've always conducted research with men who are part of a tight friendship group. So I haven't spent a lot of time with lonely single men.
And there are a few of
those.
Well,
not since I've been married. It's not a bad thing, really. And so one of the things that I've taken lots of insights around men in the research, but one of the things that definitely happens to men is when they get into full-time work and they're spending a lot of time at work and they do work hard, and then whatever time left over is spent, you know, with the kids, is they let those friendship circles and networks and intimate relationships that they might have formed at school, sometimes they slide. And that is ironic in a culture that venerates male mateship, you know, and all the rest of it. Actually, I think that men really need to be better at being friends with other, and the ones
Australians
that
are bad at mateship? That's fascinating. Australian men are bad at mateship.
They really are, in terms of the actual practicalities of mateship.
When there's not a war.
When there's not a war. But the men that are good at it, that's mainly the men I've met in their 60s and 70s. They're brilliant. They're wonderful. They are really enjoying life. It's actually those networks of male relationships that really can save those groups of men from a whole range of things, depression, early death, and I've just seen it time after time. So I think, Australian men have to be better at mateship.
The arrival of Donald Trump into the White House has sparked a whole lot of debate in Australia. You know, it was Australia, since we're just like America, apparently, and we're about to get the same thing here. I mean, you've talked about things, two of the things that have been flagged as one of the drivers of support for Donald Trump, which is increasing job insecurity. And the other thing is anxiety about people from other countries, particularly Muslim countries, coming to live in Australia. What's your research telling you? Is there a wave of Donald Trump-style populism about to arrive in Australia and affect the political landscape, Rebecca?
Yes and no. So the first thing, if we're to believe the quantitative research, is that Donald Trump is not a popular figure in this country compared to, let's say, Russia. So he's not somebody that, in fact, we did a poll at Essential that asked, listed a whole lot of things of what would be a threat to international security, peace and prosperity, and amongst everything, including climate change, Donald Trump was the number one. So that being said, the kinds of things that his narrative is tapping into are here. Now, what saves us is a couple of things. First of all, what saves us is that we don't have any kind of national pretensions to greatness. So to say, make Australia great again, Australians are like, we don't go in for brass brands and being a great world leader. It's just not part of our psyche. So it's not going to work as much. That kind of idea that we've lost status or lost face to the Chinese doesn't have, it's not that it's not there, it just doesn't have that kind of level of resonance. We've also been lucky, for various reasons, to avoid some of the extremes of wealth and disenfranchisement, particularly around race. Not entirely, but that there are in America. If you look at the stats, we just don't have a toiling mass of underclass. We do not have a toiling mass of working poor. We have a working poor and an underclass, but it's just not at that level.
And a universal healthcare system.
And we have a universe. Mm. We have some things that really save us. We're also not. We like to say we're a Christian nation, but the stats just do not back it up. We are not a nation where there is a significant, evangelical vote or a significant, committed Christian vote. And you see that in national polls around belief in evolution versus creationism. You know, maybe less than 5% of people in Australia don't believe evolution's real. A terrifying number of Americans believe that evolution is made up by the same people who made up climate change. So there's a range of things that save us, but we will not be saved ongoing if our political culture doesn't address all of those things that the Donald Trump narrative taps into.
How absolutely fascinating to speak to you once again about this stuff, Rebecca, and thank you very much for this. This is the fruit of 9 years of work of you going into houses with half-flush toilets all around Australia, in the country and cities. It's been fantastic to hear these stories, and I hope this is all true. That we have more in common than we think, and we're better off than we've been imagining in the last few years or so. So lovely to speak with you, Rebecca, and thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Huntley is the author of Still Lucky, Why You Should Feel Optimistic About Australia and Its People.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Our website is abc.net.au/conversations. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.